Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, October the 2nd, 2025. This is episode 3741 of the Survival Podcast, and it is Thursday. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I got a good lineup for you, as always. And as always, Dr. Ron Paul is leading off today with the Liberty Report highlights for the week. And he's asking a simple question along with his partner here. Did Israel just win control of TikTok in the name of protecting Americans? I mean, we had to get this away from the Chinese government because they're influencing opinions of Americans and collecting their data, and we need to get this back in the hands of them. If we're going to have this app, it needs to be in the hand of Americans. Is it really in the hands of Americans now? Do you trust Israel with your data and influencing the opinions of your children and your grandchildren? They're using TikTok, do you? I hope you don't, but I think that's what's happening. Nicole Sauce will talk about becoming an energy engine. This is part of her Resilience series. This is Resilience Series Part 4, and it is the final in that series. Good stuff from Nicole. Chef Ken Daniels has got a series of his own going, lesser-known cuts series of beef cuts. Today we'll talk about the Denver steak, one of my favorites, by the way. I've actually got the primal cut that the Denver comes out of sitting on my smoker right now, but because I love y'all that are coming to the workshop, I didn't break it down. I'm smoking an entire chuck roll right now. I mean, it's on the smoker as I'm recording today's show. That will be part of the Saturday meal at the workshop. Andy McCann will talk to us about how, you know, it doesn't always, not everything about getting older has to suck if we take care of our bodies. He's got some good tips on that. Carrie Brown will talk about not confusing devil's walking stick and elderberry. This is a new one for me, but it sounds like it's a good thing to know about. John Pugliano will give you a twofer. Remember, John is actually a ham radio guy and very big into radio communications as a whole. So he's going to talk about radio communications for people that want to make sure they have some redundancy in case the cellular networks are down. And he's going to talk about reinvesting dividends, stocks that automatically reinvest dividends. And then Jesse Markowitz is going to talk about using Start 9 for self-sovereign artificial intelligence LLMs and how, yes, you can do that, but there are limitations, at least right now, based on the technology that runs a Start 9 server as to speed being the primary one. But it's also something you can do yourself outside of Start 9 if you want to. And then I'm going to be talking to you guys about Bitcoin. It's October 2nd. If you're a Bitcoiner, you're familiar with the term Uptober. And Uptober is really every year for Bitcoin, especially in green years. There is the traditional four-year cycle, three greens and one red. But it's the last green year before what's supposed to be a red year is what we call the cycle, right? And Uptober is usually the top for that cycle, and that's when Bitcoin just rips. It's usually had prior cycle highs. There's been a bunch of debate. Will it get back there? Was that it? Is the top in? You know, was the top in May? Was the top in July? And every cycle it's been like this. And there's people that have always been like, no, you didn't pay attention to the first or the second or third. Like, we know how this works. October will come. And here we sit with Bitcoin back over 120, at least at the time I'm recording this, having gone down about 110. The world's ending. Calm down. The world was ending when it went to freaking $600, wasn't it? People just, it's a strange place. But my question for you, and some thoughts I have on it today is this going to be the top for this cycle? And if you could look at my show notes, the word top is in quotes. What I'm going to talk about a probability of occurring this year isn't even necessarily to say that as we come through October and November and out the other side of this year, that there might not be some pull down in Bitcoin. When I say the cycle's over, I don't mean that it won't go up and down anymore, and I don't mean it'll go up forever, nonstop, with no corrections in between. And I don't even mean that there might not be some significant corrections at times, and those might not even approximate the corrections of the past. I'm saying they just won't be what they were. Like, are the days of the 80, 90% drawdown and then 3 years to get back there, and then one big year on top of it, and then going doing it again over and over. Is that over? I'm going to tell you, I think the odds of it being over are somewhere between 70 and 80%. And I'll give you some reasoning as to why. And once again, I will answer the nonsense of, well, I should have bought Bitcoin when you told me to the last 400 times, but I missed the opportunity. How many times are you going to miss the opportunity before you realize you didn't miss the opportunity? You're missing the opportunity. I bought Bitcoin today. I bought Bitcoin yesterday. I bought Bitcoin the day before that. I bought Bitcoin the day before that. I bought Bitcoin the day before that. I bought Bitcoin every single day this year. I started doing a daily Bitcoin buy in October. So I'm almost at a year. October of last year. I have not gone a day without buying Bitcoin. Not one. I've even had my cash balance drop below my daily buy a time or two on Strike. Woke up, hey, my Bitcoin buy at 3 o'clock didn't go through. Charge it up, make a one-off buy, and let the recurring order go back in. I've not missed a day. So when I tell you that you should be investing in this, it's not because I don't know anything else to say. It's because I'm telling you, you cannot advise somebody more honestly than to advise them to do something that you yourself do every day. Let's just keep that in mind when I get to my segment. Anyway, real quick before we get started, let me remind you guys you can help support us by doing your online shopping at a little bitty website that really is just a web page, and the domain just takes you to that page. It is tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You go there, you can help us out no matter what you buy. My item of the day has been the same for like 9 days in a row now. I don't know when I'm going to stop mentioning it, but I sold over 300 sets of them already, and you guys are still buying them. They are the Anker Soundcore V20i open ear headphones. I love these things. I mentioned yesterday, I even had them on the video yesterday and showed you what they look like. I don't understand how y'all that use earbuds that don't have hooks use earbuds that don't have hooks and do shit like run on a treadmill or jog on a road or ride a bicycle and they don't fall out of your ear. Mine fall out of my ear by sitting still and they fall out, especially my left ear. And it's annoying, and as I've said before, as I've been mentioning these things, they always seem to fall out the worst time, though. Like when I'm leaning over a pond or a thing of duck pool shit water, and plunk, fortunately, all the ones I've ever owned are very waterproof, but it's not. I don't want to put it back in my ear after it's been in there. Or a big pile of grass, and the lawnmower kicks it out. You get what I'm saying. Like, this is just a chronic thing. No matter what type of earbuds I had, it's not about how they sound. It's about how they function. These function beautifully, and they're $23 and change if you're a Prime member. To me, the audio quality is up there with like Apple AirBuds or something, or AirPods, or whatever the hell they call them. I mean, the quality of the sound is great. They have an app you put on your phone. You can individually control your graphic equalization, etc. You can set up presets for different types of music, whatever you want to do. $23. They work. They last a long freaking time, and they don't fall off your head and go into poop water. So I suggest you get them before Anchor discontinues them, because everything on my spider sense is telling me they've kept them on sale this cheap this long. They're getting rid of them. They're liquidating inventory. So do it while you can. Anchor Soundcore V20i. You can find them at tspaz.com or just go to my website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and start scrolling. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul about Israel taking over TikTok in the name of protecting America's privacy.
Well, it's interesting. Now, TikTok is a social media platform. I've gone on it. I don't spend a lot of time. The vast majority of their short videos, the vast majority of them are silly things. But they're the younger generation. That's the way they communicate. The Gen Zers, the Zoomers, they call them. That's how they like to communicate. The vast majority of what's on there is not political at all. But a lot of what is on there happens to be, that is political, happens to be sympathetic more toward the Palestinian side in this conflict. Now, the numbers, the polls that we've talked about on the show over the last few months play out this idea that the younger generation does not hold the same sympathies for Israel that the baby boomer generation held, right? So things are shifting in terms of preference. So the idea was they've got to do something about this. And Israel itself has said, we've got to do something about TikTok. We've lost these young people on TikTok. We've got to turn it around. So it turns out they basically, and this is the reason that we are talking about it, because otherwise it would be a private business sale that would be none of our business, but the U.S. government got involved. Remember, Congress passed a bill to shut down TikTok. We've got to take it out, shut it down, don't let the kids on it at all. Because under the guise of the Chinese are stealing our information, those evil Chinese. So it turns out what the real goal was is to get rid of the pro-Palestinian taint. So what they do? Well, they sold it to Larry Ellison, who is, and if we go to that next clip here, a year ago, powerful critics in Congress in the tech world were complaining that TikTok was promoting anti-Israel messaging and were suggesting it needed to get shut down. But Dr. Paul, they found out there's a better way. They decided to force the owners of TikTok, the Chinese owners, force them to sell it to Larry Ellison and a consortium of like-minded people. As you know, Dr. Paul, Larry Ellison made his fortune doing business with the CIA, who's very good at stealing your data. He's the second richest man in the world. But here's the most important part, Dr. Paul. He is the single largest private donor to the Israeli Defense Forces, and he's referred to the State of Israel as his own state. So extremely, extremely pro-Israel, he and his group, and now they've gotten control of TikTok.
This is going to aggravate things on the long run. It may look like a total victory, you know, for Israel. The way the headline said, Israel wins TikTok.
Yeah.
Is it a permanent win? I would say politics is never permanent.
Yeah, the thing that people may underestimate, particularly older generations, I would include myself in that, as sad as I am to say it, is the impact of TikTok as a news dissemination device. Now, put that next one up. Where Dr. Paul was reading from the $14 billion sale. Go to the next one there if you can. this is incredible, Dr. Paul. This shows the power. As people move away from broadcast news, they don't trust it. Aside from its more than 1.5 billion regular users worldwide, and I highlight this, TikTok has now become where 30% of Americans get their news. That's powerful, Dr. Paul. Now, not only will American companies like Oracle, which has numerous government tech contracts spanning defense, intelligence, and civilian agencies, have access to TikTok's user data, it will also have control of the algorithms that manage the kind of news, the messaging, and images that all of those users will see. This is a massive coup, I think, against free speech because of the involvement of the U.S. government in this.
That, of course, is a big deal.
Yeah, I'm sure we're all much safer and better off now than we were before. I mean, come on. You know what you call this? You know what you call this? For all the left shrieking and yelling about Nazis, 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 what you call this is, again, you call this the Trump administration engaged in overt fascism. That's what you call this. Not Nazism. Fascism. See, fascism leaves the power in the hands of the private sector, but the success of the winners and losers is chosen by the government, and then they all play grab ass with each other. And then they leverage the difference between the classes to advance the goals of the state and industry. This is, if you get off of the TikTok news and you get off the news and the media and you actually look up the economics of what makes a nation fascist, you'll see that it's not Trump that's making the United States fascist. It's not the Republicans making the United States fascist. It's not the Democrats making the United States fascist. It's the entire system of economics that the United States has been running on since about 1913, and then it just keeps getting ramped up with each new way that we turn more power over to the banks, and that would be 1964 and then 1971 and then just the policy since 71. But the Trump administration here literally did fascism. You know, just like when they took their piece of Intel, we just took 10% of Intel's, you know, value. We just the United States government now holds 10% of Intel. See, it's not socialism in the classic sense, because Intel's still a private company. But now the government can, when Intel has problems, say it's in our best interest to fix the problem for Intel. Or when it does something to set Intel up above its competitors, say, we're looking out for the American people. If you want, if you're a competitor and you want us to look out for you, then maybe we need 10% of Samsung. This is fascism. This is what fascism looks like. See, the problem is that the American people are stupid, and you have been convinced that fascism means guys in pretty uniforms with swastikas locking people up in camps. That's Nazi, not fascism. Fascism is a thing. Nazism is a flavor of fascism. It's not fascism. Franco, that ran Spain until the 1970s, who was neutral in World War II, was a fascist. He did not have people rounded up and put in concentration camps and gassed to death, nor did he have brown shirts marching through the streets. But he was 100% fascist. We have neo-fascism. We look at, make it look more free market and what have you. But that's the government we have. But it's amazing to me, these are two things the Trump administration has done that are not just fascist. They are fascist beyond the norm for fascism, if you get what I'm saying there, right? So what I mean by that is that it is typical the U.S. runs on a fascist economic system, has since, you know, over 100 years. But there's times where we go way beyond the kind of the median norm that we've created for fascism. And when you take 10% of a company, that would be an example. When you bail out the auto industry, that would be an example, right? When you privatize profits but make losses public, that's fascism. And that's when you're exceeding things. We've done all these times over the years where in an emergency, we've bailed these people out, we've backfilled the banks. That's fascism at an accelerated rate. So the two places Trump's actually done it, the people that supposedly want to fight fascism got not one word to say about it. Isn't that interesting? All they care about is if their blue hair content creator is still on TikTok. Bread and circuses for everybody, I guess. Anyway, let's hear from Nicole about becoming an energy producer, and not in the way you would think.
Well, howdy TSP, Nicole Soss here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee to do the fourth in the series of building resilience when, well, times are tough or through hard times. And this is the final in the series of four. And today we're going to talk about stacking your capital one tangible win at a time. So you've fixed your systems, you're showing up consistently, and you've started building a real community around you. And so now it's time to build the stable, resilient life that you've just dreamed of the whole time. So this starts with energy, your energy. You don't need a 5-year plan to get everything done because that's not very useful if you don't have any gas in your tank. So how do you get gas in your tank? You create an energy engine by tapping into 4 of the 8 forms of capital that you can build now. So I think when people talk about wealth, they usually mean money. But from a resilience standpoint, there are different kinds of capital. And I alluded to that in the last segment. So there are 8 forms of capital that were presented by Appleseed Permaculture, I believe, to build a stable, thriving life or system. So only 4 of those, though, feed your energy when I looked at them, and the other 4 feed off of the first 4, so to speak. So if you don't have that balance, then you end up stalling out. And we all know we don't want our engines stalling as we're building our futures and our resilient life, because that's how we get through hard times. So the first is living capital that will build your engine or fuel your engine. And that's like your physical body, the food you grow, the water you drink, the things that are living. Second is intellectual capital. This is like your knowledge and stuff that you've learned. And, you know, like you go to university, you learn a thing, right? Well, that's your intellectual capital. How powerful that is that, though, without the third form, which is experiential capital. And that's when you actually undertake the thing, like building a rocket mass heater or Putting together a coffee roasting business. That is experiential when you have finished it. And the things that you learn as part of that, maybe tapping into your intellectual capital to make it happen, but they feed the energy of your capacity to move forward. And then the fourth one that's part of your energy engine is your spiritual capital, which is your deeper reason for even doing what we're doing, right? This is why you show up every day. This is what gets you out of bed. This is how you keep consistency, even when it's hard. So stacking these four together can give you the real fuel you need, which is clarity, focus, momentum. And once that engine is humming, you can start stacking the rest, which is social connections, shared culture, tools and infrastructure, and money. Just because some people say money's kind of evil and icky doesn't mean it actually is, and it is an important part of your eight forms of capital. You can get a lot done if you have a little extra cash hanging around if something goes wrong. So none of these grow really well, though, if you're running on fumes. And when the lights go out and the grocery shelves are empty and the zombies are coming in your windows and all of those things, it's not your bank account that keeps you alive necessarily. It's energy you've built into your own body. It's energy you've built into your mind and spirit. It's the things that you have, the living things around you that can help feed the entire system. And I'm not just talking about when zombie apocalypse happens, also like when an ice storm comes and you got to deal with it. Or in March 2020, you know what happened here? I'm about to say something you're not expecting. Really bad tornadoes tore through Tennessee and they took out all forms of communication but radio, because radio, you know, works on air, electricity, and it was days. It, like, in a really bad way. So we had to depend on other things to live in our day-to-day. And you know what's a real bummer when that happens is when you are not physically able to do it because your gas tank is empty. So as I looked at this, the hard truth is I used to think I was doing fine. Productive, tough, resilient Nicole Sauce, right? But I didn't realize how much energy I was just leaking into the ether every day until I did something that may seem a little weird and separate from building. Like, how does this build energy? 75 hard. 75 hard. 75 hard sounds like a fitness challenge because you have two workouts a day and you have to drink water and you nutritionally, you stick to a diet of your choosing. Like, by diet, I don't necessarily mean I need to lose weight diet, but like, this is the foods I will eat. And by the way, you're not doing it right if the foods you will eat every day are Doritos. Just saying. Anyway, no alcohol, reading every day, enough water every day. Doing 75 hard really opened to my eyes to some things that I was not taking care of. It wasn't just the fitness part, which did come. It was also that I got a mindset reset every single day, no matter what. I had to make something happen. And what I had to make happen was two workouts, drinking water, eating clean, reading 20 pages of a book. That part wasn't hard for me. No alcohol and no excuses. You had to take a photo every day. And if you forgot any one of those things, you had to start your day count over for 75 straight days. And it worked. And it doesn't, like, this is something that a lot of people have tried and a lot of people have failed at, right? And so I was pretty excited when I saw John Bush at the Live Free Academy start his own 75 Hard. Because what 75 Hard does is it teaches you to stop negotiating with yourself and start showing up with energy every day. You know what the result was? More mental clarity, more physical strength, fewer excuses, a faster bounce back from things that would happen, and confidence that I could just get stuff done. And I will say this, as I thought about this segment and 75 Hard, the real breakthrough that happened comes from John Bush at the Live Free Academy when he built his spiritual 75 Hard. One of his workouts was a spiritual workout every day, and the other one was for his body. And for him, I think that looked like daily scripture reading, reflection, and pairing that with the physical discipline of eating right and the workout, that practice for him stacked spiritual capital on top of physical, building energy that fed itself in a cycle, right? And allowing him to tap into doing things more deeply than just willpower every time. So when things get tough, physical and mental capacity are what you need most to be resilient, because that can mean the difference between failure and survival. When life's easier, that same pair fuels faster progress on whatever you're working. So you can't build long-term resilience if you're exhausted, inflamed, foggy, all of the things that get in the way when your energy is low and you're trying to create forward momentum. Improving your physical health first is about unlocking all the other forms of capital that you need to bring to bear to build a resilient life. It helps you think more clearly, it gives you better skills, it gives you steadier emotions, and helps you connect with your deeper purpose. And it's the missing piece for most people. So perhaps you're wondering, why isn't this whole series about paying off debt, stacking 6 months of food in the pantry, or learning how to de-escalate conflict? And the answer to that is, you should already be doing all those things. Are you? Because you already knew you needed to do all those things. So why aren't you doing those things? The reason we started here is simple. Every bit of stability flows in your life flows from one single person, and that person is you. And no matter how hard or easy things get, you're the responsible person. So you've got to build from the ground up. You got to fix your systems that are not working. You need to get consistent and prioritize things. You need to build your community, and you need to become your energy engine, which means you need to get off your couch if that's where you are all the time. And you need to look at what you're putting into your body to fuel yourself every day. That's the foundation of becoming a responsible, prosperity-creating machine. And from there, you can stack debt freedom. You can move towards financial freedom. You can become financially independent. You can do this. You can layer on food security, defensive skills, all of those things, and do that instead of burning yourself out. So if you've listened through all four segments and are like, okay, that's cool, don't just do that. Don't nod and walk away. Do this. Pick one energy practice that you can commit to for the next 30 days. One thing, I know I talk about three things. Do one thing for your energy every single day for 30 days. Could be cutting out sugar, could be walking a mile a day, just a mile. Unless you're already walking a mile, then make that 2 miles. It could be starting your food journal to start thinking, like, how can I improve my energy based on what I put into my body? Or setting aside your 10 minutes for reflection, but choose it, write it down, post it somewhere you see it every day, and then do it. Tell one other person who can hold you accountable that you're doing that and check in. And if they're doing it with you, even the better. That goes back to the community piece, right? They're all interrelated. The truth is, when the storm comes, you will not rise to the occasion. You'll fall back on the energy habits you've built. So build good ones now while you can, even if times feel hard. With that, I should be like promoting SRF right now because it's this weekend. And you should totally come. But I wanted to mention that if you want to fuel your body with some really good food, come out to our farm-to-table dinner on November 15th. It's in Lancaster, Tennessee, about an hour east of Nashville. Check out more on that at livingfreeintennessee.com. I hope you guys have enjoyed this series. And if you have thoughts about it, hit me up. Email me, nicole@livingfreeintennessee.com. Make it a great week.
Really great stuff from Nicole Soss. She's just, every single member of this council is an incredible blessing to the community and the show itself. But there's something special about Nicole. I'll just leave it there. Anyway, next up, let's hear from Chef Ken Daniels on one of my absolute favorite cuts of meat in the world. If you've ever heard the term a butcher's cut, which is something a butcher would maybe take for himself and you wouldn't generally see it in a display case, that Denver is one of those true amazing butcher's cuts, except that it wasn't even really known about by much butchers as little as just, say, 10 years ago. It is one of those things that's been known about but not really widely shared until quite recently. It's part of the American Beef Council's effort to encourage more use and of beef cuts. They are the people responsible also for kind of popularizing the flat iron steak as well. Anyway, what is a Denver steak? Well, you're about to find out. What do you do with it? You're about to find that out as well.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Welcome back to Lesser Known Beef Cuts. This series is all about bringing you closer to the parts of beef that most folks never even hear about. Cuts that don't show up in glossy supermarket ads or on a steakhouse menu. But when you know them, when you understand them, they can give you some of the best eating experiences you'll ever have. Today we're going to spend some time with the Denver steak. And I'll be honest, if you haven't heard of it, that's not surprising. It's one of those cuts that lives in the shadows. It doesn't get the recognition of ribeye, strip, or filet, and that's part of the reason it remains one of the best values in beef. So what is it? The Denver is a steak that comes out of the chuck, the shoulder section of the animal. And here's the thing about chuck. Most people only know it as roast and ground beef. It's the part of the cow that does a lot of heavy lifting. Those muscles work, they support weight, and they move. That means tough fibers, lots of connective tissue, and for most of history, chuck meant long cooking times, pot roasts, braises. But hidden in that same section, buried under layers of harder working muscles, is a tender, beautifully marbled muscle that can be cut into steaks. That's the Denver. Think of it as the hidden treasure in the chuck. You have to do some digging to get there, but once you find it, you realize how good it is. And it is good. This is not the kind of steak that needs hours of cooking. This is a steak you can treat the way you treat your ribeye or your strip. Hot pan, hot grill, a few minutes per side, rest, slice, enjoy. So why don't more people know about it? Two reasons. First, it's just not as plentiful. You don't get a dozen Denver steaks off a cow. It's limited. Second, because it's buried inside the chuck, most commercial processors don't bother pulling it out. It's easier to just cube that whole section into stew meat or grind it for burgers. Only when someone takes the time to separate it properly does it get to stand on its own. That's why the Denver remains a secret. It's not that it isn't delicious. It's that it takes extra work to make it appear, and the truth is many chefs know about it, and they love it. Some even hate when people like me talk about it, because the more folks know about a cut like this, the more demand goes up, and the price follows. But I've always believed good food isn't something you hide away. If there's a great steak sitting inside the chuck, you deserve to know about it. So that's the Denver's backstory. An overlooked steak born in a part of the cow that usually ends up slow cooked or ground, but tender and flavorful enough to be eaten hot off the grill. Now let's talk about why the Denver deserves your attention on the plate. First off, flavor. The chuck is known for beefiness, that deep, robust, hearty flavor that comes from muscles that have done some work. When you eat a burger made from chuck, you know what I mean. It's not delicate. It's not subtle. It's beef through and through. The Denver takes that intensity and balances it with tenderness you don't expect from the chuck. It gives you both bold beef flavor and a surprisingly soft bite. And then there's the fat. Unlike some leaner cuts, the Denver usually has a generous marbling, streaks of fat running through the meat. That's the same kind of marbling you love in a ribeye. When you cook it, that fat melts, baste the meat from the inside, and gives you that juicy, almost buttery mouthfeel. It's one of the reasons this steak has been called the hidden ribeye of the chuck. It carries that same sense of indulgence, just hidden in a different part of the animal. Now, cooking. The Denver isn't tricky, but it does ask for attention. This is not a steak you want to toss on the grill and forget. It rewards care. Here's my favorite way. Keep it simple. Season generously with coarse salt and freshly cracked pepper. That's it. Let the steak sit out for about 30 minutes so it loses its chill and cooks more evenly. Then take it to a ripping hot cast iron pan with a little oil that can handle high heat. Lay the steak down and let it sear. Don't fuss with it. Let it build that crust. Flip once. Add a knob of butter right at the end if you want to take it further. Maybe a smashed clove of garlic and a sprig of thyme, basting the steak in that butter for a minute or two before pulling it off the heat. The Denver shines at medium rare. Pull it around 125 to 130 degrees internal temperature. Let it rest for 5 minutes, then slice across the grain. Slice it thin. That's how you get tenderness every time. Because of its marbling, the Denver also works beautifully on the grill. High heat, fast cooking. You want that fat to render and char just slightly, giving you that smoky caramelized crust while the inside stays juicy and pink. One more tip, the Denver does really well with fat around it. If you're pan searing, don't be shy about butter or tallow. If you're grilling, don't be afraid of brushing a little beef fat on the surface. This cut is already flavorful, but fat takes it to the next level. It amplifies that beefiness and adds richness to what is otherwise a straightforward cut. So now you know what the Denver is and how to cook it. But let's talk about why it still feels like a secret and why it's worth asking for. As I mentioned earlier, the Denver's hidden in the chuck. It's not easy to extract, and you don't get many of them from a single animal. That scarcity is a big part of why it's not on every supermarket shelf. When something is limited and takes extra time to produce, processors are less likely to invest in it. It's simply easier for them to grind it into hamburger and move on. That's why the Denver has mostly lived under the radar, known only to chefs, meat cutters, and butchers who work with whole animals. It's what some people call a butcher's cut. The kind of thing the butcher would take home for themselves rather than sell because they knew how good it was. And chefs? Chefs love the Denver. Many of them hate talking about it openly because the moment it becomes common knowledge, the price starts to climb. It's the same story that happened with the flat iron, the hanger, the skirt. All cuts that used to be cheap and unknown and now command serious prices because demand skyrocketed once the secret got out. But here's my feeling. Food knowledge isn't something to hoard. If there's a great cut of steak out there that can give you a ribeye-like experience at a better value, you should know about it. You should get to enjoy it. So if you're listening to this and you're curious, the next time you're at a butcher, ask for the Denver. They may or may not have it ready to go. You know, it depends on how they break down their beef, but asking is half the battle. It puts the idea out there. It shows you're someone who appreciates more than the obvious cuts. The Denver steak is a cut that represents everything this series is about. A respect for the whole animal, curiosity about what lies beyond the standard steaks, and joy in discovering flavors and textures that most people never experience. Remember to keep those questions coming in. You can always reach me at bloodsugarchef.com for all the latest things I'm getting into. Until next time, this is Chef Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So basically, cook it like a ribeye as far as how you cook it. I ain't saying it tastes like a ribeye. I think it's better. If you look at a Denver steak and no one tells you what it is and you don't know what a Denver steak is, you would probably think you're looking at a short rib. And it comes from a very similar part of the cow. I want to talk about why this steak is so good and why it's tender even though it's from the chuck and we think of the chuck as being tough. The chuck is something, I think a lot of people don't really know what the chuck is. If you've ever cooked a pork shoulder, that's basically a pig's chuck. Shaped a little bit different because a pig shaped a little bit different. But it comes from, if you reach behind try to pat yourself on the back from above, and you can reach down to about between your shoulder blades on your spine there. Both sides of that spine is about where the chuck comes from on a cow. Or if you reach to your back from below and you go up as high as you can and put your hand back there, unless you're really, really dexterous and you can touch your fingers together, which I used to be able to do when I'm a kid, I can't do now. That space between your hands, that's pretty much where the chuck comes off both sides of the shoulder and neck. Now, if you take away the foo-fee-foo-ness and the marketing of the tenderloin, the filet mignon, and you ask a real steak connoisseur, like, if you can only pick one steak that you can eat, they're probably going to tell you ribeye, right? And if they don't, you shouldn't trust them, unless it's like a thing like a Denver or a Sierra or something like that. If it's just the cuts that are relatively available, it's going to be the ribeye. It's got this balance. And it's more tender and more flavorful both than the strip, which is a New York strip loin above the tenderloin. So that's from the ribs down to where you hit what's called the sirloin. That strip loin there along that backbone, that's your strip loin. When you get to where the ribs are, from the ribs up to what's called the chuck, you have the rib eye. So that's just the loin adjacent to the spine over the ribs. The chuck is just where you come up to where you start into the shoulder, but it's still the same muscle groups. And that's where the chuck eye comes from. The chuck eye is from the backside of the chuck. It's about the first 4 inches of the chuck roll is what we call it. We take that whole neck off chuck roll, and they call it a roll because it literally rolls off as you take it off. Yeah? All right, and then you got a chuck clod, which is the lower part that's below that. Well, most of the time, not all the time, most of the time the way a chuck is processed is it's processed in a roast. You lay the whole damn thing down and you just horizontally cut big giant, you know, 2 to 4 inch thick, depending on how big a roast you're making, roast out of it. And then your top piece up by the neck, there'll be the last little boogery part, you throw that in a grinder. Right? So if you go into a grocery store and they have chuck roasts on sale, if you look at and you find the ones that were taken off of the part where it connects to the rib, and you look at it, one side is a chuck eye, and it'll look a lot like a small rib eye, right? Which is basically what it is. And then it'll be like this kind of strip wrapped around it. That's a Denver. So one way you can get this cut without breaking down an entire chuck, it's just whenever you see chuck roasts on sale, look at them, pick the ones that have the chuck eye in them, take them home. You barely need a knife. You can literally pull them apart and cut your portions out of your Denver strip and your chuck eye. If your butcher, you know, is smart enough to make his roast at least 2 inches thick, you basically cut that down the middle and you have 2 chuck eyes. And then you'll get somewhere around 4 Denvers, depending on how big you want to make them off the other side. But the reason it is tender is for all the talk, the shoulder does all this work and everything. Well, the part that the Denver and the chuck eye come from doesn't really work that hard. It's up against that beautiful, delicious ribeye primal, and it's that transitional space, and there's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it. You get the little bit more work, and all of our cuts that are super beefy and super flavorful, like an osso busco off the bottom of the leg, the shin, basically, or like a brisket, right? All of those cuts like that, they're really hard-working muscles. They have to be cooked a long time to make them tender, but they have that beefy, beefy flavor. And then our tender cuts are the ones that do the least amount of work, and the reason the ribeye is so flavorful is there's so much fat mixed in with that rib cap, that spinellus on the top. The Denver and the chuck eye exist in this little space. That's why there's not that many of them. You know, a couple per each side of the beef. In that space in between the hard-working and the soft-working muscle, they're the transitional. They work just enough to pick up the flavor and just little enough to stay relatively tender when cooked hot and fast. It is one of the most beautiful parts of the cow. Next up, let's hear about getting old without having it suck from Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage, and I try to help people look good naked and become harder to kill. So, I have heard multiple times, this isn't really a question, this is, you guys have been talking about this, and I had some side conversations on Telegram about this, and the question is, or the statement is, it sucks getting older, and I don't feel that way. And I tried to share that, and so I'm going to give you a 7-minute or less explanation of why I don't feel bad getting older and why you guys can change your outlook on the future of your mobility and your functional life expectancy. Okay, so the standard idea is as I get older, I'm just going to get frailer, weaker, and all that stuff. The answer is no, it doesn't have to, but your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. If you sit all day, your body is going to adapt to that and everything's going to shrink up. Your tendons and all that, it's going to be like tighter on you when you stand because it's going to adapt to the position that you're in. If you don't lift and move, your body will say, I don't need that muscle. Let's get rid of it because muscle is expensive and your body wants to live. Your body is the ultimate survival tool. It's going to do everything it can do to survive. Hopefully I can bring you that presentation right now at the fall workshop. Anyway, your body is the ultimate survival tool. It is going to adapt to survive through a lot of conditions. If you do nothing, you're going to degrade your body. Play stupid games, win stupid prizes. I am almost 52. I don't take any drugs. I can lift. I can move. I can squat into full depth. I can climb stuff. I can jump. I mean, I do crazy stuff like adventure races where we go out for 12 plus hours with a map, a bike, a compass, a canoe, and a buddy, and you jog and bike around and whatever and find checkpoints in the wood for 12 plus hours. No problem. I'm looking to do another race called the TNGA. It's the Trans Georgia something something. It's a bike packing trip. 370 miles over at most 10 days, and you just go out and do this thing. I've never biked that far. I know the undercarriage is going to get aggressive, but I look to this stuff to have a challenge to the future because I'm enjoying getting older. Probably the worst part about getting older for me is knowing that, wow, I'm not who I thought I was, and I really should change my mindset. So the whole how you eat, think, move, connect, and sleep, all that stuff, those five things, the think and connect have not done well for me. I just really put that on a back burner. I encourage you guys, show up for the stuff in this environment because it's going to help you with those two things plus everything else. Anyway, so the stuff that I care about to tell you to help you with is this. I traded in the six pack for just strength and stamina. I don't really care what my stomach looks like. Now, in giving up that caring, I've actually gotten more of that because I'm not aimed at it. Rather, I've become the person who does eat better. And if you follow Jack's advice on carnivore, ketovore, all that stuff, man, the weight just comes off. I would suggest everyone go listen to his YouTube playlist in there and just do it. It's really, it's not hard or complicated. It just ain't easy. It is true, I'm not as fast or as strong as I used to be, but I'm a whole lot smarter. I can still lift, I can climb, and I can run, and I do all that stuff. I am just smart about it. I listen to my body. My shoulder kind of felt weird this morning on one of my lifts, so I dropped the bar, rotated it, and said, no, it doesn't hurt. It was just a weird thing. I listen to my body, and I keep moving. I have lived long enough that I know what the hard and stupid things are, and I just avoid doing that stuff, and I stick to consistency and just showing up. I've been doing this for about 20 years. I literally just show up and do what the coach says. It's that easy. On our heavy days, I still lift heavy. Now, it is true, I don't do one rep maxes. Just like your body will adapt to doing nothing, and that's catastrophe. On the other side of the bell-shaped curve, when you lift an ultimate lift, a one rep max, there is catastrophe waiting to happen, and I'd like to avoid that, so I just don't do it. I've stopped chasing fitness as a fad, so I know what works, and basically it's showing up, and so that's what I do. I show up every day, 5 days a week. And this next one is kind of nebulous, but I don't really need motivation because after years of doing this, I have discipline. Discipline is so much better and will outdo motivation any day. At this point, I do all this training because I want to and I enjoy the people, not because I want my body to look well. I do want it to look good naked, but that's not the reason why I do it. I do it because of everything else. So my sticky why for doing this stuff is I want to be healthy and fit enough to coach my kids' kids in soccer. And that comes loaded with a lot of stuff. It doesn't have to be complicated. Just show up and do something. I've even picked out some things that, Jack, I'll send them over to you. You can link them. So I've got this journal. It's a pretty good journal. It's a the Dumbbell Home Workout Journal. So it's a 13-week program. You can log your stuff, journal it, and all that stuff. And then also a dumbbell set to go with it. I like these adjustable ones, so I'm going to link them to you. Don't drop these. Don't throw these. They're not made for that. They're for you to use at home in an individual capacity moving through some workout. So it's something easy that you can follow. You can just order the pieces off Amazon, support the affiliate link, you know, start at T-Spaz, and try this at home. Do a thing. If you need help, I am $1,000 an hour, or you can track your food for 2 weeks, and I'll help you for free. I want you guys to be on the other side of this hill doing great, and it just comes down to discipline and showing up for yourself. All right, guys, hey, you can follow me. I've got a podcast, Fitness, Food, and Finance. You can also find me on YouTube at AndyMcCann42. Y'all take care.
Great stuff from Andy, and he mentioned a couple resources. If you go to today's show notes and you look under his bullet point in the show notes, there will be two different links, one to the 3 Weeks to Fitness with Dumbbells book and another link to the adjustable dumbbells that he mentioned there. Let's move on. Let's talk about determining the difference between elderberry and devil's walking stick. When I got this from Carrie, I was like, really? And then I started thinking about it. I said, well, you know, I know what devil's walking stick looks like. And when it's fully leafed out, unless you dig underneath it, you don't see all them thorns. And I guess it kind of sort of can look like elderberry. You know what I'd never seen in my life? Devil's walking stick with berries on it. So I looked it up. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I can totally see it. If it's in berry and you're looking, you think, if you don't check the plant itself, There is a difference in how the berries kind of look on the plant. He'll explain it to you. But in the end, they look a lot like elderberry. They're also edible. The plant itself has edible parts, but if you eat too much of the devil's walking stick berry, it can become toxic. It's a poisonous the dose type thing. But the big thing is they're for different purposes. They're both actually medicinals as well, but they have different functions. So it's important to know. Hey, Carrie, take it away and explain this to us.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie here from Strong Roots Resources, and I want to bring you guys some information about devil's walking stick as compared to the American elderberry. And this starts because I was on a customer site on Tuesday, and on a wood line, this would be a north-facing wood line, I noticed that the devil's walking stick had set fruit. And I also noticed how much it looks like American elderberry. I've been working on this site for a couple of years now, and it's possible that I just missed the fruiting stage, or the birds just cleaned it off before I had a chance to notice. But my initial impression was, wait a minute, I haven't planted any elderberry out here. And then my second impression was, that's not elderberry at all. That's walking stick. And I'm going to take you guys through how to tell them apart. And fortunately, there's some very, very easy ways to do that. But I kind of put together a whole little compare and contrast so that when you are out in the woods and you come across these two species, which could very easily live side by side to one another, so that you can tell them apart, so that when you're foraging, you don't collect a bunch of devil's walking stick berries, which your belly, I promise, does not want you to eat. So, here's what we got. At first glance, both of these produce large clusters of small dark berries, but once you take a closer look, you can see how different they are. And it's pretty important. This is one that devil's walking stick berries are not at all edible, and elderberry, you do need to cook to render the toxins where they're not harmful to you. So I think this is especially important, especially because elderberry has a long history of human use. So their growth habit, devil's walking stick, it's actually a small tree, even though most people refer to it as a shrub. It can grow between 10 and 20 feet tall, sometimes get even taller than that, especially in wet soils, in rich soils. And its most striking feature is that it is covered in spines on its trunk and its branches. These are fairly small spines, but they're pretty vicious, pretty mean, and there's been places on this particular customer site where if I'm pulling out young ones to clear some trails and such, you got to have leather gloves. Nothing else is going to do. So they're pretty hardcore in the spines. It grows in colonies, so it sets up a lot of shoots from the same root system. Now, your elderberry, on the other hand, is always a shrub. Usually reaches between 5 and 12 feet in height, and you'll get many stems coming up from the base. So you'll have a real dense section of growth. And then especially if you prune it back or if it's cut back for any reason, it will spread and send out more shoots from that root system. So that is something that looks similar, but elderberry always has smooth stems and bark and never any spines, period. Never any spines on your elderberry. So if that's the only feature that you have a chance to look at, that's a pretty good one to start with. But we'll look at a few other features as well. Now with the leaves, devil's walking stick has the largest compound leaves of any plant in North America. A single leaf can be 3 or 4 feet long. Now this wasn't the case with the ones that I saw on this particular site, but I have seen them with huge leaves on other sites, and that's normally when the soil is wetter and richer. So these leaves are either doubly or triply pinnate. So that means they branch into many smaller leaflets, and this gives them kind of a tropical fern-like appearance, and the leaf stalks as well will often carry spines. The elderberry leaves are much smaller. They are arranged in opposite pairs along the stem, and each leaf is pinnate, made up of 5 to 11 serrated, so think about a serrated steak knife, serrated leaflets. And compared to the huge fronds of devil's walking stick, elderberry leaves are modest and pretty tidy looking. So for the flowers, devil's walking stick produces enormous clusters of tiny white flowers in midsummer. Well into late summer, as we're finding here in Tennessee. These flower heads can be 2 to 4 feet across. Really impressive. So big they almost look like giant fireworks exploding from the ends of the branches. And elderberry also produces flat-topped clusters of white flowers, but they're much smaller, usually 6 to 10 inches across is what I see around here. And while they're still attractive, they don't have that same dramatic, oversized look that devil's walking stick flowers do. Alright, we're going to talk about the berries. Devil's walking stick develops clusters of small, purple to nearly black berries by late summer. And these hang in large, branching panicles. So wildlife, like the birds, often eat them, but they're not considered edible for people, even with cooking. So they can cause a lot of stomach upset. And as far as I've been able to research in, like in Sam Thayer's books, some of my other foraging books, that devil's walking stick berries have never been a traditional human food. Now, elderberries, they ripen around the same time, turning deep purple to black, and they hang in heavy, drooping clusters. These berries are known for their use in syrups, jams, wines, medicines. But raw elderberries, along with the leaves and stems, contain compounds that can make you pretty sick. So you must always be sure to cook those elderberries before eating. And you also want to mill out or strain out the seeds. But this will destroy the toxins and makes them safe for consumption or medicine making. So to kind of close this out here, how to tell them apart quickly in the field since they can kind of occupy the same kind of ground. 3 simple checks. Stems or trunk. If you see sharp spines, you're dealing with devil's walking stick. If the stems are smooth, it's more likely to be elderberry. And then you can go on to your other, checking the other parts of the plant to be sure. So check the leaves. Giant and tropical appearing, branching into many tiny leaflets, it's devil's walking stick. If they are smaller, opposite, and have 5 to 11 neat tooth/serrated leaflets, you're dealing with elderberry. Notice the flowers and the berry clusters. If they're enormous, even several feet across, you're probably dealing with devil's walking stick. And if they're only the size of a dinner plate, probably elderberry. So I wanted to this one just caught my attention this week, so I wanted to go ahead and record this for you guys so Jack can get it out here in the late summer, early fall when these things are still setting fruit, so you have a chance to look. And let me know what you think. Let me know if you find any in your region. Devil's walking stick is it's a very interesting plant. It is a native plant, and it is a wonderful food for wildlife, so there's nothing wrong with having it on your property. And if I can answer any foraging questions for you guys or help you out with homestead design, regenerative design, those things, studying and understanding your landscape, please reach out.
All right, folks, and that was great stuff. And again, if you think this is like, well, how could you? I'm telling you, when you look up a picture of it with the berries on it, if you was in a hurry and you didn't check, it'd be actually because like again, when I got this from him, I was like, no, come on, how could you mistake it? Well, when it's all leafed out and you can't see the trunk, if you don't check the trunk, I could see especially someone new, and that's the person you would really worry about here, the person new to all this. Anyway, let's go on and hear from John Pugliano. He's done a 2-4 for us. He's going to be talking about one financial question, which is dividend reinvestments, and then the other one about staying in touch with people in your general vicinity using radio and what to use in this given situation.
Hey, TSP, I've been absent for a couple weeks. I've been battling with laryngitis. My voice is coming back. I'm going to try and get a quick segment in for you. 2 real fast questions. First one comes from Dubrovko. He's asking about radio communication and specifically what his use case is that him and his ex-wife live like 4 hours apart. And when they drop off or pick up their son, you know, they're driving both 2 hours in one direction to meet, to pick up the son, and then they go back their other way. His concern is, you know, if there's some kind of a regional emergency or roads are closed, hurricane, cell phone outage, whatever, you know, how do they communicate in the meantime to say, hey, I'm going to be 20 minutes late, or, you know, we need to meet at an alternate exit, whatever. He's asking about the Baofeng radio, which you know, given what it is, it's a good little radio. It's very inexpensive. It covers the ham bands. You can use it pretty much on everything else, the family service, GMRS. And then, of course, there's separate radios that don't require a ham radio license to just use GMRS or family service radio. Bottom line, though, in your particular case, and I'm also assuming here that your wife doesn't want to deal with a lot of training and knowledge, I would simply go with an old school CB radio. This is almost the perfect use case for that. The reason I say that is because, yes, CB radio is old school technology, but you know what? That's an advantage. It's old school technology. And to me, the CB radio is the snub-nosed 38 revolver of the radio world. Yeah, it doesn't do everything, but in an emergency and when you need something just very simple, it works great. I won't go into all the advantages of it, but I think the most important thing with a radio is its power output. On a CB radio, you get 4 watts of AM power, and if it's built for single sideband, it's 12 watts. That's far more simplex distance than you're going to get out of any Baofeng or any of those other little handheld radios. And especially if you combine that with some kind of an external antenna. And, you know, for your car, it can be something simple. It doesn't have to be, you know, a 9-foot stainless steel whip antenna on your bumper. A clip-on antenna or a mag mount, just something very simple that's also easily removable. And that CB radio is going to get you far more line of sight distance than all these other little handhelds. And you don't have to keep it on your car. You know, buy yourself a small little radio and a small antenna. Keep it in a bag in your trunk and just pull it out for emergencies. That's what I'd recommend. One more thing that I think makes CB radio so great in an emergency, besides their simplicity, it's just availability. Yeah, you can get anything overnight on Amazon, but with a CB radio, if you're on an interstate, every truck stop is going to have antennas or other accessories, and they're all plug and play. So there it is, bottom line, CB radio. Dubrovko, you know how to get in touch with me. If you want specifics, reach out to me. Moving on to an investing question, Penny is asking about dividend-paying stocks, and specifically with the dividends. Should she just take that in cash, or should she choose the option that allows it to reinvest in the stock? This is one of those questions that is endlessly debated by people that are, quote, experts, and they'll make arguments one way or the other. Here's the simple way that I look at it. Dividend-paying stocks, in a way, are a little bit of a shell game. Now, don't get me wrong, I love dividend-paying stocks, but I love them a lot more like 3 or 4 years ago when cash was trash. And what I mean by that was, if you remember not too long ago, you were getting paid virtually no interest, even in a money market fund. Well, that's all changed since about 2022. Most money market funds are paying at least 4% still. That's a fairly decent rate of return for just having cash. And so what that means is, you know, going back 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't want to keep cash. And so I would look for good quality dividend paying stocks. And effectively, it wasn't so much that I was investing in them. I was just parking my cash there until I looked for a better growth opportunity. The reason I say that is that, you know, most people buy dividend paying stocks because generally they're considered to have a lower beta, meaning they don't go down as much as the regular market when the market goes down. That doesn't insulate them from going down. You know, but the other side of that is that they also don't go up as much when the market goes up. And remember, in building wealth, you're worried about what your overall net worth. Not is it staying stable, but is it growing? And so when I look at dividend-paying stocks, I don't think it really makes a lot of sense to reinvest the dividend, because you're reinvesting in, for the most part, lower growth stocks. People that generally invest in dividend-paying stocks consider it income, right? They want to know that every quarter they're going to receive a certain amount of money, and they're going to use that for their cost of living expenses. Well, if you're not looking for that monthly or quarterly income from the dividend stocks, then why invest in dividend stocks at all and have it reinvested when you can just invest in a growth company that's going to make you more money in the long run? Now, I'm painting this with a broad brush, but just in general, a company like Amazon doesn't pay a dividend. It takes the money that it would otherwise pay in a dividend and it reinvests in its own company to create future growth and profits. So again, if you don't really need that dividend income, then why have it paid to you so that you then simply go back and reinvest it in that same company when you can just invest in a company like Amazon that's constantly reinvesting its profits in its business. Hey, and one final note about, you know, dividend-paying stocks not necessarily being that safe. Again, remember, you can get at least 4% in a money market fund right now. There are only about 50 or 60 stocks within the S&P 500 that pay a 4% or more dividend. So if you're looking for, you know, better rates of return than you're going to get on a money market fund, your universe is limited anyways. And then even within these big Fortune 500 companies that are paying a 4% plus dividend, more than half of them are currently trading below their 200-day moving average, which means effectively they've lost money over the last year. That's more than half of them. And right now, as I record this, all but two of them, right? So 58 of these high dividend paying stocks are all down at least 10% from their 52-week high. So yes, dividend paying stocks are stable, but they still can and do lose money. Hey, as always, thanks for your questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Standing Podcast.
The investing advice I'll just leave alone. I just want to add something to the CB advice. What you always need to do when you get something for emergencies, and if you can see me right now saying for emergencies, I look like Dr. Evil and Austin Powers with the big air quotes, for emergencies, right? Like, is you have to use it in non-emergencies, or when the emergency comes, you will not be able to rely on it. And then for something like this, you have to have a protocol, which is when you're en route with the kids, then you have to have it on. So you want to just set up so it's always on. And the other thing I would say is that I've played with CBs quite a bit over the years, and I can tell you that almost all the traffic is on Channel 19. Break 19, right? That's the trucker channel, which means all those other channels, it doesn't mean no one will hear you. It just means you probably aren't going to compete with anybody. The other thing I would tell you is, most CBs have, you know, like a standard band, and what's called single sideband, which actually expands your range. And if you have both of the radios set to a specific single sideband kind of tuned in as well, then you're going to get more range. And then next is that this is illegal, but no one gives a shit. And that is, you can have it tuned, is the term I think is used in the industry, which basically means somebody fiddles around with it for you and ups its output so that it has more range. And again, this is illegal. I believe it's 4 is the limit. It's like 4 watts, and it's a federal, and no one ever that I know of has ever had any problems. Now, there are people that will jack their shit up to like 50 watts and then go cause problems. And there's actually ham radio operators that have clubs that will hunt them down or whatever. But if you're driving around and you've doubled or even tripled the output of your CB so that you can communicate with somebody on a bandwidth or a channel that almost nobody's using on a single sideband, you're not going to be bothered by anybody, I promise you, because almost every trucker out there that's on Channel 19 rolling down the highway has had his CB tuned up, all right, or whatever they want to call it now. So that would just be something you might want, because when I heard the distance y'all are from each other, you're probably not getting that done if you're both just getting on the road. With where you're at. You probably ain't even with what I said, but it will extend the range. But no matter what you do, this is something you guys want to have worked out how to use it and that it works and where it works and how it works before you need it. Don't just stick them in there and talk to each other once on it and go, okay, we're good. Ex-spouses sometimes are not the most agreeable people, but this one requires a little bit of after-the-fact practice. To be something that you can rely on. And I would say that might include, you know, one check-in with each other over CB on every pickup, just as a way to have some, you know, mental muscle memory, I guess you'd call it. All right, next up, let's hear from Jesse Markowitz on developing your own sovereign LLM, your own AI that you can completely control using Start9 or with other methods, and why you might want to consider it.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I've got a question from John. John asks, I noticed that my Start9 server has a program called FreeGPT2, which would allow my personal GPT to be self-sovereign. If we're serious about using the LLM for building a business, is sovereignty something we should consider? Have you done this personally? It's a great question. Let's dive in. For those not familiar, LLM stands for Large Language Model. It's basically the AI that most of us are familiar with these days. Services like ChatGPT and Grok are LLMs. There's an open source LLM program called FreeGPT-2 that you can run on your own StartOS server. There's some clear advantages to having a self-sovereign AI. First, privacy. When you run your LLM locally, all your interactions stay on your machine. With public AI services, your prompts and conversations are visible to the provider. Even if they say they won't use it for training, they still have the data. Like anything else, terms of service can change, exceptions may exist, and if they are hacked, all bets are off. Running a local LLM gives you peace of mind that your information isn't going anywhere. Next, cost. Once you have the hardware, running your own open source LLM is free. Whether you make one request a month or 1,000, it's all the same. Nothing extra leaving your pocket. No monthly fees. Finally, control. With a local LLM, you decide how it runs. You can choose the model, tweak it for your specific use case, control the settings, when and how it updates. You're not locked into someone else's one-size-fits-all setup. There are, however, some definite trade-offs. First, performance. StartOS servers don't currently support GPU acceleration. GPU stands for Graphics Processing Unit, which is a specialized electronic processor designed to accelerate graphics rendering and perform many parallel calculations. That ability to do many parallel calculations also offers extra processing power for AI. StartOS servers today are more limited since they can't take advantage of any GPU in the server. It's a feature on the roadmap, but it'll be a while before it's available. This means local LLMs are slower and less powerful than cloud-based ones. If you wait until StartOS supports GPUs, or you make the effort and take the extra time today to install FreeGPT-2 on a different operating system that supports GPUs, you will discover that GPUs can be quite expensive, and trying to add enough GPU power to match a large cloud provider is going to be very, very challenging. Next, context windows. Large cloud providers have much more compute ability and keep a larger context window, how much text or data the model can process or remember at one time. This limits how much data can be used to generate your response. A cloud AI with a larger context window can include and process much more data in responding to your prompt. This generally results in higher quality responses. In addition, responses generally come back much faster. ChatGPT can read a large document and answer your questions about it very rapidly. A local model may have a harder time responding based on the entire document and might take longer, perhaps 5, 15, 30 seconds or more to respond, depending upon the size and complexity of your document and prompt. If you have a smaller number of requests and they're not particularly time sensitive, it's fine. But if you're building a solution at a large scale, a local LLM may not cut it. Personally, I've used FreeGPT-2 and found it surprisingly effective. I run it on my own StartOS server. For me, it's been a fun and useful way to experiment. I can ask it questions I might not want to send to a public AI and just play around without worrying about data leakage. I also have a friend who's an author. He sometimes writes about sensitive topics, murder mysteries, criminal enterprises, and occasionally erotica. Doing research for his writing might not look so good, so running for a public interface is not preferred. For him, keeping everything on a local LLM makes perfect sense. In my own case, I started experimenting with training my local LLM with in-depth information on specific technical topics and using it as a help desk client. It's an ideal situation for running local. I'm experimenting and building. Slower responses aren't a big deal. If it works, and I want this to be able to support high volumes of inquiries, I could then look to migrate to a large cloud provider. So, to summarize, running a local LLM makes sense for privacy, cost savings, customization, and experimentation. For intense usage, heavy-duty business, and time-sensitive responses, the public cloud models have the advantage in response quality, speed, and scale. This has been Jesse Markowitz with your personal BitcoinAssistant.com. I'm always glad to answer your questions on Bitcoin, StartOS, and related technologies. Please keep sending your questions into Jack. I really enjoy answering them. And if you'd like to meet me in person, I'll be in Atlanta the second week of October for the Atlanta Bitcoin Conference, and then at Jack's workshop in November, where I'll be giving a presentation on StartOS. Hope to see you there.
I do think in time more and more people are going to be running their own AI LLMs customized specifically for things that they care about more than everything else. Not everybody needs an LLM that can tell you about French literature and permaculture in Regen Ag and fishing lures and what kind of mushrooms you can eat and how to make a recipe for goulash and what the taxonomic name is for a beetle. And you see what I'm saying? Like, these things know everything, and I think that as we get more and more, and the stuff that we're talking about doing here, it kind of does that. But we're getting more and more toward where people, I think, will want things that are drilled down to very specific expertise level in very specific things where they can be more accurate than the broad knowledge. But we'll see, because as, you know, services like ChatGPT are so convenient, and then you have the ability to build what we call custom agents there, and the others are allowing similar type things. If you can do that with the convenience, will people really go self-sovereign? Or will it be something hybrid-like? Will it be something hybrid-like? And what I would say is that would be a perfect description for WordPress. That's how WordPress, most people today do not use their name.wordpress.com and let WordPress do everything. They download the WordPress open source software, they install it on their own server, but then they're still using the updates and everything from WordPress. That model seems to me like eventually where we get to with AI. And if you can go back in time, many of you were not there at the dawning of the internet. You were drooling on yourself or having your diaper changed. You're not born yet, many of y'all. It's crazy that that much time has passed. And many of y'all that are old enough, maybe you weren't paying attention to it that much. And the blog wars were over by the time you even noticed. But if you go back to about, 1999, 2000-ish, right in there, 25 years ago, there was a time when there was a lot of blogging platforms. Just like there's a lot of AI platforms today. There was Blogger that eventually Google bought, and there was Blogspot, and then there was a bunch of stuff, and there was WordPress. And WordPress did something that ChatGPT did early on and then took away. And it's crazy to me that they took it away, but I think it's because they thought they were losing control, and that is they allowed something called plugins. The reason WordPress is the most dominant, not blog software, but the most dominant website software used on the planet is because of plugins. And it seems to me that the AI group that decides to truly allow plugin integration might be able to repeat history. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Let's talk about forecasting the future in a place I think we have a little bit more understanding of where we're going with right now, and that's Bitcoin. That's my segment today. I have listened to Bitcoin influencers since 2012. I really started stacking in earnest in 2013. Spent way more of it than I should have. I'd probably be if I had kept every Bitcoin I ever bought, I'd probably be talking to you from Jakistan right now. But it's just, my point is, it's been a while. It's been more than a decade. And I've heard every cycle except the first one. Well, this is the last one. This is the last one. The cycle's broken. And it's only been two cycles that I've heard that, right? The four-year cycle, 12 years, is three of them, But it feels like more because people say it all the time to get attention. You're 2 years into a four-year cycle, and they're talking about the cycle being dead. And the cycle ain't even done cycling for the cycle yet, and they're talking about. So I've heard this so much, and it's up there with things like, will Bitcoin hit 800,000 by next month? Experts tell you why it could happen. Like, it's clickbaity, especially with videos. YouTube, you know, Bitcoin YouTube is just ripe with, if I put up a thing that says Bitcoin is going to give you minimum 15% per year returns for the next 20 years, I'll have one view, which is a very conservative and you know, it's probably going to do way better than that. But if you can find anything that will guarantee that, then you're in pretty good shape, especially if you're young and just getting started as an investor. But nobody cares. If I put up something there that says $1 million Bitcoin is inevitable, it'll get massive views. And this cycle-ending thing has been used that way so much that I have really shied away from talking about it. However, we're entering a space where it may very well be the case this time, or what has been termed the super cycle may begin. I don't like that term either because I think it paints an unrealistic expectation. When the cycle predictability truly ends, when we become more attached to equity markets as a whole than we are to just this four-year cycle, I think the cycle remains as an echo. Because the cycle is based on the halving. And when you have something in high demand and the output of new units gets cut in half, it has an impact. And then there's a psychological component to that, and then there's a marketing component to that. That each cycle, while Bitcoin is in its new low, brings in new blood, and some of the old blood doesn't move. It just keeps doing what it's always done, and thereby building the ecosystem. So I don't think that goes away. But what I think must go away at some point is three great years and an 80% drawdown, and then three great years and an 80% drawdown, and three great, like, that's basically what we've had. And it's always made up for itself, plus it's outperformed every other asset there is across a decade or more, and really going back to 2009. So, you know, we're not that far away from it being two decades of outperforming everything else on the planet measured in a five-year span, okay? But there are things in place now that some of it's just pro-Bitcoin and some of it's just economic reality. And a huge part of it is something I've talked to you a lot about, and I told you it was going to happen 3 years before it did, which is exactly what happened under the Genius Act, with banks now able to issue stable coins, effectively bringing stable coins under FDIC. Russia's taken notice of this, by the way, and their main finance guy, I don't think, really understands how stable coins works, because what he's inferring is the United States is going to just print a shitload of dollars in the form of stable coins as though it's new money, but it's not new money. It's stranded money becoming active. But the bigger thing is where the money goes. So right now the banks have massive amounts of money holding U.S. bonds, federal bonds. And they hold that money in the bonds as a reserve. And the issue with that reserve is they can't really do anything with it. It just sits as like zombie money. But a stable coin, the bank that issues the stable coin under Genius has to have one of two things. A dollar for everyone, just a dollar sitting somewhere. They have a dollar on their register that's a legit dollar, not a liability masquerading as a dollar. A legit dollar, right? Or they have to have a dollar in a bond. In a U.S. government-issued bond, okay? Not a bond for the city of Sheboyganville. It has to be, or a bond, for, you know, a junk bond from a company. It has to be a federal bond. Well, they have lots of those federal bonds, and they can borrow money to buy more of them, okay? And now they can then send that money out while still holding it. This increases their reserves. Even though they have a liability against them, it's no longer seen that way. And what this does is it pushes billions, in fact trillions of dollars, out into the world that currently exists already. It's not true inflation, but it becomes inflation by moving and multiplying through the economy in its effect. The thing is, the vast majority of these synthetic dollars, right, these stable coins, will not be used in America. We don't need them. We have no need for it. I mean, we can do some things with lending and leverage and crypto bullshit games with them and all, but the average person has no need of a crypto dollar. Because we have bank accounts, we have debit cards, etc. All our shit is already denominated in dollars. Everything you own is denominated in dollars if you're an American, even though you don't realize it, unless it's a true hard asset. And even those are truly denominated in dollars. Of course, your gold or your silver stash is not denominated in dollars, but how do you place value on it? By saying it's worth X dollars an ounce. Okay? So the fact that you can go to the store and you can use any of 5, 6, 7 different payment methods and they're all dollars already and whatever you're holding in reserve is in dollars, you don't need a dollar. But if you lived in Turkey, where the Turkish lira has just been inflated to dog shit, the dollar looks pretty good. And there's you know, more than half the countries in the world would feel that way. More like 70% of the countries in the world would rather have dollars in their hand than their native currency. Because the math says so. So now what you do is you proliferate those dollars across the world and you diffuse inflation for a time, but at the same time you're devaluing the dollar. Now, what does Bitcoin do in relation to the dollar? Well, it grows in relation to the dollar's devaluation. So you've got that. You also have the ETFs, which we got, you know, last year. And that there's maybe 200,000 Bitcoin out of that 1.25 million Bitcoin in there now that's even up for being sold and traded short term. There are people who are traders. I don't mean like they're bad people. I mean they're traitors. They trade with Bitcoin. They go in and out of the market. A lot of the people that do high-frequency trading have moved to using a standard brokerage account and using the ETFs for trading because it saves them a shitload of money on fees over places like, you know, Gemini or Coinbase or whatever. So there's a lot of traders that are using the ETFs because of super low fees in and out. And so there is some volatility there, but most of the ETF money is long-term lockup money. It ain't going nowhere. And then you've got, you know, one entity in MicroStrategy well over 500,000 Bitcoin right now, more and more of these companies. So you have people that are just, there's a certain amount of Bitcoin that just won't move, that used to move. And the reality is there's more Bitcoin being stashed away in a long-term storage right now than the miners produce. In other words, we're already on a net negative circulatory supply of Bitcoin. We are net negative on what's available. And we got to where we are for most of the time that we've been doing it without that actually being the case. A full net negative relative to the total supply. In other words, the available supply is shrinking. At a time when we are intentionally devaluing the dollar, and the United States government, one way or another, is in a leverage play here to turn Bitcoin into a strategic reserve. You put all of that together, and you just look at the maturity of the asset, and you look at all of these companies that aren't even operating yet, that will be going into operations over the next year. And then all of these companies are starting to snap to, I lose money by holding money, and there's no place I can put my money that's truly a good place for my money to sit while I'm not leveraging it, except Bitcoin. And I think what you're going to get is, like, again, this echo, this shadow cycle. In fact, I'm going to call it that right now, and somebody will rip it off by next year, if I'm right, anyway. The shadow cycle, where you'll be able to look at the next four-year cycle. And if you look at it and if you adjust the graph, right, if you adjust the axis to exaggerate the vertical, it'll look exactly like the previous 80% drawdown, but your drawdowns will be more in the 10 to 20% range, something like that. And again, I'm not saying this is a definite. I hate the way this has been used to attract attention, clickbait, rage bait, whatever, okay, in the past. But I'm going to put the odds at this is somewhere between 70 to 80% the days of the 80-90% drawdown are gone and replaced with a shadow cycle that is maybe 3 up, 1 down, except the 1 down is very, very tolerable, which could in time erase even the shadow cycle because everybody knows is the thing right now. So everybody gets really antsy. Everybody gets really greedy about October time right now. Everybody stays a little bit greedy in November. Reality starts to set in, and then everybody goes on the fear and greed index, goes to fear in December, and then by the time you get to January, February, March, you got misery, 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 misery. And you get this huge tumble down. And the beauty in that has been for the people that understand it, we just go, I don't care, I'm buying it all the way down, but when that shit gets down to the floor, I'm buying the crap out of it. Right? You know, if I have a daily buy of $10 a day, when it hits the floor, I'm buying 50 a day as long as it's there. That is the benefit of it, but for the stability of the asset, the fact that everybody knows this, so there's so many people that just simply at the end of that cycle, they just take their profits and wait. And that's not a terrible strategy either, at least it hasn't been. The reason it's never been fully like everybody should do this is because everybody knew that sooner or later that's not the way it works anymore. And when you're all out of Bitcoin and the big moves happen, you usually don't get another shot at them. I still remember the dude who sold half his Bitcoin when it hit 25,000. And this guy had a lot of Bitcoin. It was millions of dollars worth. He sold his Bitcoin at $25,000 because he said, now that it's this high, it's like any other asset. Take half of it as your profits. And I think he's still waiting to buy it back because that was his plan. Well, when it goes down again, I'll buy it back. I don't think you can get a chance to do that, buddy. I think you dumped it at the wrong time. Anyway, with that, hope you guys enjoyed today's show. I did enjoy doing it for you. If you're not a Bitcoin investor, I fully recommend that you become one. It's easy to do. I don't have any real strong relationships with anybody. If you use my links, I make a few bucks here and there. But the reality is, like, one of the easiest places to do it is Strike. Strike's probably my personal favorite. There's a lot of other options, though. The one I used to recommend a lot that I really don't recommend anymore just because their spreads are too high and their fees are too high is Coinbase. I don't hate them, just better options, especially if you're not a shitcoiner. And the thing about them, of course, is they just shove the shitcoin casino down your throat constantly. They email you about the latest shitcoins, etc., because they can make a lot of money selling shitcoins to stupid people. That's why I prefer Bitcoin-only exchanges. Strike, River, Swan, all of them are great. I don't really care what exchange you use. As long as once you get up to about $1,000, you're moving that into self-custody. And if you keep doing that process over and over again, it doesn't matter where you buy your Bitcoin. I'm not worried if the exchange shut down and you lose $200. I am worried about if the exchange does something or the government writes a letter or whatever and you have, you know, your life savings or a huge amount of money locked up or stolen. That's what I'm worried about. That's why I'm such a fan of self-custody. With that, again, I appreciate you guys tuning in today. One more time, you can always support this show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Shop there and you help us out no matter what you buy. Again, the Anchor Q20i, open-ear earphones, these things are just awesome. I love them. I spent about 30 minutes today getting everything done for the Ducks and on a phone call with Nick Ferguson with them. And, you know, it was perfectly clear, great phone quality, and I listen to music with them. I listen to podcasts. I listen to audiobooks. $20. $20. Come on. Get a couple fair because when they're discontinued, you're going to wish you did. With that, I'm going to ahead and wrap up. Thank you for tuning in. Have a great day. I'll catch you on Monday with a new show.
You should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Crowd. You don't
revolution.